Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off last time. I'm going to do what I did last time and share my screen with you with the slides. And then we'll pick up. So Benedict is going through this whole thing about how the Mass itself developed. And he's talking about what, you know, the foundation of the liturgy and all those kind of things. And there's a big argument that goes on between people when you look at the Last Supper. Some people say it was an actual Passover meal. Others say it wasn't really because it was a day early. In John's Gospel, he talks about it being a day early. And so you look at the elements. There's a lot of good argument to say that the Last Supper was begun as a Passover meal, but didn't end as a Passover meal because there was no lamb there. None of the Gospels talk about the lamb being present. And if you remember from John's Gospel, when Jesus was arrested and they took him to the Praetorium, some of the Jews said they couldn't enter because they would be unclean entering a Gentile facility and they would not be able to eat the Passover meal. And so there's a lot of indication in John's Gospel in particular that all this stuff happened a day early. So Jesus shifted the thing about, because in Exodus it tells you specifically on what day you have to do the Passover meal. And so he shifted it one day. And of course, his resurrection shifted the Sabbath for us by one day instead of Saturday and Sunday. So all those things are in the background of Benedict's mind as he's going through this foundation of the liturgy thing. If you recall, the apostles kind of expected that what Jesus taught would just be a continuation of Judaism, because they went back and began all their teachings in the temple and synagogues and all like that. We do in the Acts of the Apostles now with the readings, and he keeps talking about Paul and the rest of them going into the synagogue and teaching these people. So there was this kind of expectation that the Jewish religion would just kind of morph into what Jesus taught, and it would encompass everything, all the Gentiles and the Jews, not just the Jews anymore. So that presented a bit of a problem for him, because the Jews had these historical requirements given to them by God that the Passover would be a perpetual event. And then he had Yom Kippur, which is a one a day thing for the sins of Israel. Now, what do you do with all these Gentiles that are coming in? The Exodus means nothing to them because they weren't slaves of Egypt. And the Yom Kippur thing, they're not part of Israel, so doing that to forgive the sins of Israel doesn't really impact them much. And so there was this kind of transition thing going on. So how do you take these two things and merge them? And right now in the readings of the Acts of the Apostles, if you remember, you know, last week and over the weekend, they're Paul and Barnabas are coming back talking about all the wonderful things they did with the Gentiles and development, everything like that. And so they had to, you know, Peter has to get up and say, blah, 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 you know, it's okay. And then James gets up. Now, why did James get up and start talking right after Peter talked? Peter was the head apostle. The decision was his, okay? But then James got up and said, okay, he made the decision. Here's now how we're going to implement it at the First Council of Jerusalem. So he was the local bishop. So he had the responsibility for that area. And Achaeus, he was one of the first martyrs too, because they didn't like what he did or what he said, so they chopped his head off. You know, so one way to get rid of your pastor is to chop his head off, you know. So all this, with all that kind of a background, the apostles had to go into the world. So they had to spend a lot of time thinking about all the stuff Benedict is here talking about, you know. What do you do now? We need some kind of liturgy. What should it look like? What should it be? What, you know, what should it incorporate? They had their Jewish background, all the stuff that goes on in the synagogues and all. So they kind of drew on that. And over time, they came up with what turned out to be the Mass, the first part of which looks like a typical synagogue, worship service, and then we have the Eucharist added to that that Jesus gave to us. So it tried to use both, and that's why we use readings from both the Old Testament and the New Testament in the Mass. So Benedict says that the foundation of the liturgy, its source and its support, is the historical Pasch of Jesus, the historical sacrifice of Christ. In the first stage, the eternal is embodied in what is once for all. So you see that phrase used, once for all. It's Jesus died once for all of us. And so people don't understand what happens in the Mass, non-Catholics in particular, because they keep saying, well, you're killing Jesus again, and obviously we're not doing that. And you're cannibals because you're eating this dead flesh, Well, no, we don't eat the dead flesh of Christ, It's an unbloody, it's a representation of the sacrifice on Calvary to God the Father as part of the heavenly liturgy. A lot of people, even a lot of Catholics, don't understand that we're actually participating in that heavenly liturgy when we go to Mass. So he's talking about this whole thing, this once for all thing. And then he said the second stage is the entry of the eternal into our present moment in the liturgical action.
Do you think that if the church emphasized Bible study more, like you're doing, to help us to understand the Mass?
I think it's a reaction to what they finally realized after a long time, that for the past 50 years, adult Catholics don't understand their faith. And so it's this whole idea of evangelization within the church as well as without the church, outside the church, and to try to help the everyday walk of the mill,
understand.
Catholic understand their faith.
But they can only do that with what you're telling us.
Yeah. And that's,
they don't have the Bible background.
They don't have the Bible background. And that's why a lot of parishes are starting to do these things, these Bible studies and all, There are a lot of parishes that are taking our podcast and downloading them and using them for their adult ed program, So there are all kind of ways that this is going on, but it is necessary, because if we're going to be true Catholics, we need to understand our faith. And, 98% of the Catholics in the pews on Sunday really don't.
And then they don't get that relationship like the Protestants do by doing that Bible study.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So those are the kind of things that we have. And so those are the things that Benedict is talking about here, the development of the Mass and everything else. He said the second stage of this development is the entry of the eternal into our present moment in the liturgical action. That idea of the eternal Mass going on in heaven entering into the Mass we do on earth. And that's a real mystery to a lot of folks, what? You tell them that, oh my God, And the third stage is desire of the eternal to take hold of the worshiper's life and ultimately all of historical reality. The third stage is God's desire to take control of our spiritual development so that we understand where we're going and why. So we have the desire to be in heaven all the time. It's not just maybe I'll go there one day kind of thing, It's a desire to be there. And that has an impact on us in a societal way, because when you look at people, at all the different things they're doing to try to prolong life. So the idea is to live as long as you can, not to live as well as you can. The object of our life ought to get us into a state of grace where we can go straight to heaven. That's the goal, to be in such a state of grace that we don't have to go to purgatory. And in fact, one of the priests, for the Faber, I think it was, wrote a book, Hell and How to Avoid Hell, stuff like so. For a long time, there have been some priests that have been trying to get us into that mindset. But the idea is to be ready to die anytime, and if you do, to make sure you go to the right place, the right direction. Don't take a detour, Pasco and get $200 and go to the wrong place, Don't want to do that kind of thing. So the thing that helps us get there, of course, is the liturgy. Because Jesus said, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you, divine life. So where do we get that? We get it at the Mass. And that's why Padre Pio said that the earth could survive more easily without the sun than it could without the Mass. The Mass is so important. And most people, and the Blessed Mother at Medjugorje said that if you really understood the graces that you receive and the value of every Mass you attend, you would go to Mass every chance you got. Yeah. So the liturgy, the immediate event, makes sense only because it contains these other two dimensions, this morphing, this presentation of the sacrifice of Christ, and that idea of the eternal participating in our temporal Mass. And so when we understand those things, then it becomes, it helps us, make more sense of what we're doing here. So that's all part of this time and space and liturgy thing he's talking about. He says, Christian liturgy is no longer replacement worship. We don't replace the Jewish ceremony with something else. It's the coming of the representative Redeemer to us. He's not replacing anything. He is the representation of God for us in himself. An entry into his representation that is an entry into reality itself. He's the Redeemer. So we do indeed participate in the heavenly liturgy, but this participation is mediated to us through the earthly signs. We participate, we do so through the earthly signs because we're corporal beings. We need those earthly signs because that's what we are. Which the Redeemer has shown us as the place where his reality is to be found. So he's already told us, okay, if you want me to come into your life, this is what you do. If you want my divine life to be embedded into your temporal life, you want that indwelling Trinity, here's how you do that. And he told us how to do it. And it's interesting because God has told us how to worship him since Exodus. And Bennett makes the point that every time we invent worship on our own, we're inventing it for ourselves. We're putting ourselves ahead of God. And that's not good. Because the follow on is what we see in a lot of non-Catholic churches of whatever denomination, because they have a pastor. If they don't like what the pastor preaches, they fire him, right? And they hire another one, or they just quit that church and go form another one. We see that happening in the United Methodist Church right now, where they're going to split. There's a big article the other day about it. There's a traditional part. Now, the United Methodist Church was formed in 1968, 7 years after I got out of college, okay? And then now they're going to split already. Well, I'm old, so maybe this already isn't the right term, but because they've been around for a few years. But they're going to split into the traditional side, which doesn't go along with this LGBT thing, and the progressives who do. And so now they're trying to figure out how to amicably split the church. And then which parishes are going to go, or communities or whatever, are going to go with the traditionalists, and which ones are going to go with the progressives.
Well, I think today is the vote in Germany in the Catholic Church.
Yeah, whether to do all that stuff. Yeah. Germany is on the way, hell-bent on schism right now. They're going to be a schismatic church. Right. I feel sorry for the faithful Catholics in Germany because they're not going to have any place to go.
I think because the government contributes the money to both
they do.
Lutheran and the Catholics.
They do.
So they naturally become secular.
Yeah, it's a money thing. A lot of the money thing was what propelled Luther to do his thing in the first place in Germany. So you got to watch the Germans and money.
Oh, yeah.
They get you every time. I can say that because I'm Italian, I'm Irish, I'm English, I'm Scotch, but I'm not German, so I can say that. So this whole idea of liturgy is to bring us into that reality of what's actually happening there. So, it's bringing Jesus into the present And it's the turning point in the process of our redemption. The institution of the liturgy of the Mass is that critical turning point in salvation history that brings the process of redemption home to us, the fulfillment of that. Started back with Abraham, but it's fulfilled in Jesus. So that's the good shepherd takes the lost sheep onto his shoulders and carries him home. He's carrying us on his shoulders. And like he said in Divine Mercy, you know, he's the one that's got to sanctify our souls. We can't sanctify him. And so he's got to take us, put us on his shoulder, and take us up to heaven. It's got to be him, nobody else. So we go back now to the spirit of the liturgy, the other book. And he's talking about, you know, well, what do you do? He says the calling together, the assembly, coming together in one place to do this worship, he says, has a purpose. And that purpose is worship, but worship the way God called us to worship. The call comes from worship and leads back to worship. It is worship that unites the people called together and gives their being together its meaning and worth. So he calls us to be community. And so we have two ways of worshiping God, two ways of praying. We do it communally at the Mass, but we also have private meditation and prayer and contemplation. Like Jesus says, go to your room, close the door, and talk to your Father in private, you know. So we have two ways of, with this, with the liturgy is where we get called together as a body and assembly that has a particular purpose, and that purpose is worship. And that's why, unlike a lot of other churches, when you dedicate a Catholic church, it's dedicated for one purpose only, to worship God. It's not a meeting hall. It's not a place to have a picnic or a white elephant sale or something like that, okay? The only purpose of a Catholic church is worship. Period. That's it. And so it's this worship that unites the people that are called together. And it's the fulfillment of that whole idea of all of us being part of that mystical body. The mystical body of God comes together to worship together and to offer ourselves to God the way he offered himself to us, for us, in his sacrifice. So he says, well, I just said that. He says, the Catholic Church is consecrated for only one purpose, and that is the worship of God. It's not a sometimes meeting hall. The tabernacle must always be respected. If you're going to do something in a church that's not conducive to that, you take the tabernacle out and you put it somewhere else. If you're doing a major renovation to the church and the workers are running around all the time, fixing stuff and hanging, you know, hammers banging and all, you don't keep the tabernacle in the church there. You put it somewhere else. Okay? So we come together to hear God's word and to seal everything with his sacrifice and to receive the benefit of that sacrifice in the Eucharist. So now he's getting into the idea of the sacred place where that liturgy takes place. You know, if you can do a liturgy, where do you do it? And he's talking about the sacred places. So the Christian worshiper no longer looks to Jerusalem. The temple doesn't even express the hope of Christians. It doesn't even exist anymore. Christians look to the east, to the rising sun. The song of the sun in Psalm 19 is seen to be about Christ. David wrote a lot in the Psalms about Christ without realizing that, because he was inspired by God, okay? And so the reason we look to the east is because tradition says that when Jesus comes again in the second coming, he's going to come from the east to us. So a lot of times, so the idea behind building a church is that when you build a church, the altar should always face east. It should always orient it so that the altar is facing east. So we looked at Christ as the meeting place between man and God. He's not just the person, he's also the place within himself where all of this meeting takes place between us and God. So praying to the east means going to meet the coming Christ. as we pray forward. We're going forward to meet him and let him then bring us to heaven. He said, when I am raised up, I will draw all men to myself. So our orientation toward him is part of our being drawn to him so that he can do what he wants to do with us. So it's an anticipation. It's an anticipation. I thought I heard somebody talking. So praying to the east means going to meet the coming Christ. It's an anticipation of that second coming. So this is where he's going to talk about when you make changes to the Mass, only make them in recognition of the fact that we're getting closer and closer to that second coming event. So the symbolism of the cross merges with that of the east. The cross says Christ sacrificed himself. The second coming says, I'm coming back to take you with me. Like he told the apostles, remember the gospel? He said, where I'm going, you can't come, but I'm going to come back and get you. I'm going to go prepare a place for you. He's preparing a place for each of us. I want to see my place. I want to see what my house looks like. It's going to be a log cabin or something else, you know? He's going to, for each of us, have the most perfect place we could possibly have because he knows us so well, right? You're going to walk in and say, oh, wow, I love this. I like that. I like that oven there. I like the microwave here, you know. I love it. It's great. So in Matthew 24:30, Jesus says, then on the first day will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. It comes from. And then they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now he's told us this in the gospel in Matthew, but also in the prophets. He talked about this in Zechariah and in the book of Daniel. So he's been telling us this for a long time. So the question is, how do you think this relates to what Jesus told Faustina about the time of darkness? When he said, everything will be done and all you'll see is my cross in the sky. All the light you'll have will be where I was nailed to that cross. And so in Matthew 24, Jesus says that on the first day will appear the sign of the Son of Man. The sign of the Son of Man is the cross. The Son of Man comes, and you don't, it's not a sign, that's reality. But the sign of him is the cross. So he was telling us in Matthew what he later confirmed with St. Faustina in her diary. So the liturgy is also cosmic, about all of creation. When the purpose of liturgy is finally completed, all of the cosmos, all of creation will be sanctified, made holy, because God made it. Anything he makes is going to be holy. So the theme of creation is always embedded in Christian prayer. Through the liturgy taking place at the altar in all the churches of the universal church, we're also simultaneously contemporaries of the liturgy of the Logos, of the Word of God. Jesus' Mass being offered before the throne of the Father in heaven, as we see in the Apocalypse, in the book of Revelation. I went to Washington one day, and I was touring through the Franciscan Monastery down there. You've been there? Mm-hmm. And it's really cool to go through. And there were some people there that were Catholic, so they didn't understand some of the stuff. But there was one place where there was this big structure, and across the top of it, it said Apocalypse. And this lady said, what is that? I said, it's just Greek word for Revelation, book of Revelation. She said, oh. <You know? laughs> So, but that's the whole thing, you know. A lot of what Jesus gave to us in the book of Revelation was telling us what's going to happen, you know, what's coming down the pike. And so we have to just recognize that that's part of God's plan, and we're not going to change it, so we just deal with it. So the Torah is replaced by the Gospels, which alone can open up the real meaning of the Torah. And that's the whole idea about how the Old Testament points to the New and the New fulfills the Old. The continuity, the organic growth of salvation history continues primarily right now through the Mass and the sacraments. So the Word of God spoken through the rabbi in Jesus' time, teaching from the Torah, continues today, spoken by the bishop, teaching from both the Hebrew Scriptures and from the Gospel. So we see both of those in every Mass we go to. God continuing to address us here and now, and making his teaching relevant to us here and now. The liturgy of the Eucharist is celebrated as we look up to Jesus. We look to Jesus facing east, waiting for that second coming. And in the Gospel of Luke, excuse me, we haven't studied Luke yet, but in the Gospel of Luke, he says, when you see it coming, don't be afraid. He says, raise up your head and exclaim with joy, because you know it's now time for you to go to heaven. He's assuming you've been preparing yourself to go there, okay? A lot of people don't. Oh, excuse me. Thank you. In Israel, only men had to participate in divine worship. Women stayed in the galleries. So that was part of their culture. The women did not have the same respect that men do in terms of worship. We see that even today in some religions. We have some friends who are Mormon, and the mother, when we've got our goats, we got them from them, and so we got to know the family pretty well and all. And they have a different education program for the women than they do for the men, which is kind of interesting, you know? And they're not allowed to read anything anti-Mormon. When I went to Salt Lake, I told you I would go into Salt Lake City for these conferences, so I'd go visit Father Sweeney. Well, we took a tour. Mary Beth and I took a tour of the headquarters in Salt Lake City. And we were talking to this lady behind the counter, and we said, well, what do you think of the Pope? She said, who's the Pope? They're so sheltered from what's going on, they had no idea who the Pope was. And these people were like 40, 50 years old. You know? Amazing. So in Israel, only men had to participate in divine worship. Women stayed in the galleries. In the Church of Jesus, no such distinction exists. Everybody comes together to worship. And he kind of hinted at that, because look at all the women he brought into his community with him when he was in his public ministry. You know, Mary Magdalene, Mary the wife of Cleopas, and all these others that were there that helped the apostles, provided for them a lot. Even in today's reading, in the Acts of the Apostles, we saw Lydia. They dealt in purple garments and stuff, and she became one of their providers because she had a certain amount of wealth. So even though women do not serve as priests, they have a clear and important place in the sacred space where liturgy is celebrated and God is worshipped. And John Paul II talked about that a lot too. He said, because women are not priests by God's design, doesn't mean he thinks any less of them than anybody else. I mean, he picked a woman to be the one to bear the Son of God. And you don't do that to somebody you have a low opinion of, right? So, yeah, God likes thick ladies. God likes ladies. That's good. So altar in direction, the architecture of a church should reflect the continuity from the Old Testament to the New. A place had to be established that would properly provide for Christian worship, the ministry of the Word, and celebration of the Eucharist. A place also had to be provided for baptism. And we pretty much do that all in one place now. Sacrament of Penance went through a long development, which itself had an influence on church architecture. You know, where do you put the box? Also, the question of sacred images had to be resolved, because some people had this notion that when you make a sacred image, you're now making an idol. Even some non-Catholic churches today believe that. Oh, you worship idols, you know? No. Do you have a picture of your family in your wallet? Yes. What's the difference? No difference. church music had to be accommodated as well. So they had to go through a lot of thinking about how all these things were going to come together and be used in a church. And so what should a church look like? How should the architecture be developed so that all these things could be incorporated into it? And that's, you know, an important thing. So that's something that took a long time to finally figure out. So each thing that was accommodated had to be reconciled with the liturgy. Everything, the confession boxes, the music, everything had to be accommodated to the fact that a liturgy was going to take place. The Mass is going to take place. And so that's the central thing. And so when you have church music, the Mass doesn't support the music supports the Mass. Anytime you have an organist that goes crazy and wants to keep playing and playing and playing, as the priest is sitting there waiting for it to finish so you can continue with the Mass, the priority has gotten a little screwed up, you know? And I've seen that happen sometimes, you know? You probably have too. So the question was always there, what is the harmony with the essence of the liturgy for all these other things? And then what detracts from the essence of the liturgy? You don't want anything to detract from the essence of the liturgy. So one thing has remained clear for all of Christendom. Praying to the East is a tradition that goes back to the beginning of Christianity. Because we've been waiting for the second coming for a long time. Look at Paul's letters, his early letters. He thought it was going to happen tomorrow. You know? So modern man has very little understanding of this orientation to the East. Judaism and Islam, now as in the past, take it for granted that we should pray toward the central place of revelation. So the Islamists orient themselves toward Mecca. I'd be a terrible Islamist, you know, because I have no sense of direction whatsoever. If somebody said point east, I couldn't begin to tell you what direction east was right now. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to go about, where's the sun? You know, right. Is it rising or setting? You know, I have no sense of direction. My Uncle Bill had an amazing sense of direction. He grew up in the woods in Oregon and married my mother's twin sister. So he took me to downtown New Orleans one time he went to pay his electric bill. And you could do it at one of the department stores. So he said, I'm going to drive over here. I'm going to let you hop out, go in and pay the bill, and I'm going to go around a block and pick you up. No, the other way around. I was driving. He said, I'm going to go in and pay the bill. You go around the block and pick me up. And, I mean, I lived in New Orleans my whole life, right? And that's the bad part. So I dropped him off. I tried to go. Oops, one-way street. So I had to go down. Couldn't turn. I finally ended up out on Basin Street somewhere. You know, 20 minutes later, I pulled back in front of the store. And he's standing there waiting for me. He said, what happened? I said, I got lost. He said, going around the block? But that's my sense of direction, you know? It doesn't exist. So this orientation thing, you got to really know what you're doing. If you're the architect, you know, which way is east so I can orient it the right way. So the Judaism always pointed toward the temple. And now they point to the east. And the Islamists point toward Mecca. In the Western world, an abstract way of thinking dominates. God is spiritual and everywhere, so why should prayer be tied to any given direction? That's the question we get all the time, you know? What difference does the direction make? Because of Christian universality, looking to God as the only God, aware of his revelation, we should express in Christian prayer our turning to our God of revelation. We should always turn to God for everything we do.
So where did the temple, the Jewish temple, point?
East.
I don't
east
know.
Also? No.
Probably
no.
East. I don't know. I don't know if it, you know, it depends on which shape it was.
Right.
You know, maybe.
Is it a cross?
So I don't know. We'd have to go look at the thing of it. I'm sure there's a lot of literature available on the temple and what it looked like and everything else. The second temple was not nearly as. Yeah. Where's Google, right? Where's Alan? He did Google for us for the perfect heifer last week.
Weren't the churches made in the shape of a church, though?
Well, they had these porches all around.
Cross,
yeah. I don't know.
That's what I was told.
I don't know. But he had all these different porches and porticos and everything else like that. Mm-hmm. But the Holy of Holies was the central part. That's where everything, mm-hmm. that's where God resided. So then, in what direction should we pray during the Eucharistic liturgy? In the Byzantine church, the orientation to the east was preserved. All their stuff looks to the east. In Rome, a different arrangement developed. The bishop's chair was shifted to the center of the apse, APSC, not AIPS, and the altar was moved into the nave. This is apparently the case in the Lateran Basilica and in St. Mary Major. In St. Peter's, during the pontificate of Gregory the Great, the altar was moved nearer to the bishop's chair, most likely so that he could stand as much as possible above the tomb of St. Peter. Because that's right. Have you been there to Rome? You know where that thing is with the green chapel and all? Okay. This reflected the understanding that we celebrate the Eucharist in the communion of saints, a communion spanning time. So it's this whole question of how you should build and orient a church. So the custom of erecting altars above the tombs of martyrs goes back a long way and is an outcome of that same motivation. Because of topical considerations, St. Peter's faces west, which is interesting. Because it wasn't flat land. It had a lot of topological considerations. It was also built over a cemetery, an old Roman cemetery, and the only Christian buried in that cemetery was St. Peter. So they were able to build. In order to build a church over a cemetery, you had to have a Christian buried in that cemetery. So the liturgical renewal of our own time developed from this, a new idea for liturgical form. The Eucharist, so it was said, had to be celebrated toward the people. In other words, the priest started facing
What was the reason?
It says the liturgical renewal of our own time.
Yeah.
After Vatican II,
right.
When they came out, it said developed from this a new idea for liturgical form. Mm-hmm. More of Bognini's influence. The Eucharist, so it was said, had to be celebrated toward the people. So you had the people facing the priest facing the people. It's like some people refer to it as a spiritual circular firing squad. The altar had to be positioned so the priest and people faced each other. This alone, so it was said, was compatible with the meaning of Christian liturgy, with the requirement of active participation. This alone conformed to the primordial model of the Last Supper. So those are all the arguments they used for doing this. Okay. So that was the thinking after Vatican II with Bognini and company. After the council, when he says council, he means Vatican II. Altars everywhere now face the people. It really does look like a characteristic fruit of Vatican II's liturgical renewal. It is the most conspicuous consequence of a reordering that not only signifies a new external arrangement of places dedicated to liturgy, but brings with it a new idea of the essence of liturgy, is bringing back the idea of liturgy as a communal meal. You know, I'm preparing what you're going to eat on the table. You can watch me prepare it. You know, I'm Rachel. I'm making my little meal, and all you people in the audience can watch you make it, then you can eat it. Okay.
So you think that was valid?
I don't like it.
Oh,
it's
right.
Probably valid, mm-hmm. But not what was intended. And nothing in the Vatican II documents said to do it. You know, all they said was take some of the prayers and translate them. They didn't see anything about reorienting all this other stuff. So the idea that a celebration facing the people must have been the primitive one, and especially that of the Last Supper, has no other foundation than a mistaken view of what a meal could be in antiquity. In no meal of the early Christian era did the president of the banquet ever face the other participants. They all sat or reclined on the convex side of a C-shaped table. So they had a C-shaped table. They all sat on the outside. Then the servers, the servants would come and serve him from the inside. And so at the Last Supper, you know, a lot of the paintings show a big table that probably wasn't, they probably didn't have a table. You remember the movie, The Passion of the Christ, mm-hmm. where Jesus is building this table? And he's talking to Mary about how he's going to make a chair, and he shows us, and she says, it's never going to catch on. You know, chairs and tables, they'll never catch on, because they reclined. They had short tables, and they reclined for a meal. Mm. But they all reclined on the same side right. of the table. And that's why one of the, John Jackson's wife, she grew up Jewish. She became Catholic. And he was one of the ones that did the most detailed study of the Shroud of Turin. And she wrote a paper. It's a really interesting paper. Where she proposes the idea that the Shroud of Turin was actually the tablecloth used at the Last Supper. And the reason she came up with that idea is because when you examine the shroud carefully, you can see stains from a place setting for a set of plates that were on it and the right number of plates. Yeah. And it's also a very expensive cloth. It's a herringbone weave. And you would typically not use that expensive a cloth to bury somebody in, because it would cost too much. And so for a lot of different reasons, she believes that because everything was closed for Passover, so the shops were not open. So where are you going to go buy the burial cloth if the shops are closed? So the closest one was the table, and it was long enough to use for him to lay on and then fold over to cover him both back and front. So she had a lot of reasons for thinking that, but there's no definitive proof, you know. But it's an interesting paper, a very interesting paper. So in no meal of the early Christian era did the president face, you know, their participants. We talked about that. There was never any notion in ancient Christianity of facing the people. The communal meal had the opposite connotation, that everybody was on the same side of the table. And that's why the early Mass had the same thing. The priests would face the altar and the tabernacle. People would face the same direction. The priest is leading the people in worship to God. He's not preparing a meal for them. Okay. So very soon, the new reality was separated from its ancient context and found its proper and suitable form, a form already predetermined by the fact that the Eucharist refers back to the cross and thus to the transformation of temple sacrifice into worship of God that is always in harmony with the Logos, the Word of God, the incarnate Word of God. We must not forget that it was not the priest alone who then faced east. It was the whole congregation with him. Everybody faced east. Now the priest or presider, as some call him. Some don't even call him a priest anymore. They call him a presider, which, you know, I argued with a priest one time. He did that on the internet. I said, you're not a presider, you're a priest, so act like one. You know? I really got into him. And then I argued with another one that was a Lutheran minister who had been a priest, and he gave up the priesthood to become a Lutheran because he had an argument with his bishop. He stomped his foot and said, I'm going to take my ball and go home. So he became a Lutheran. And then he got married. And I got on his case big time. Oh, man. I really got on him. I told him, you know, first of all, when you celebrate the Eucharist in the Lutheran church, you're committing a sacrilege. It's a mortal sin. And you're making yourself worse. But I said, even worse than that, you took away from your wife something she was entitled to. And that was a sacramental marriage. She could have had that if you had not done what you did. But now she can't have that. You took that away from her. And he didn't answer me back. So everything depends on the priest now. He becomes the real point of reference for the whole liturgy. Everything focuses on the priest, not on God. Everything depends on him, not God. Everything depends on him. We have to see him, respond to him, be involved in what he does. And that was the other part of the liturgical thing they did after Vatican II, where all of a sudden the whole congregation is constantly involved. You don't have time to sit and think or pray or anything else. You just got to be constantly involved. Whereas in the traditional Latin Mass, you can be quiet. You know, you can actually be quiet and pray during liturgy. His creativity sustains the whole thing. So people try to reduce this newly created role by assigning all kinds of liturgical functions to different individuals and entrusting the creative planning of the liturgy to groups of people who like to and are supposed to make their own contribution. Less and less is God in the picture. More and more important is what is done by the human beings who meet here and do not like to subject themselves to a predetermined pattern, a pattern established by God. The turning of the priest to the people has turned the community into a self-enclosed circle. When Mike got his first assignment, he was fresh out of seminary, but he was kind of a, you know, in-your-face kind of guy sometimes. So he got his first assignment, and they had this liturgical committee that would put together what should happen in the liturgy, right? So they went to him and said, okay, here's what you're going to do in the liturgy. He looked at him, and he said, really? He said, it's my Mass. I do what I want in the liturgy. You don't tell me how to celebrate the liturgy. And they looked at him like he was crazy. Mm-hmm. But he did it anyway, you know? So I was proud of him for that. So people try to reduce this newly created role by assigning, yeah. So, yeah, we just did that. So in its outward form, it no longer opens out to what lies ahead and above, but is closed in on itself. Turning to the east did not mean the priest turned his back to the people. The person of the priest was not important, just as the synagogue congregation looked to Jerusalem, to the Christian liturgy, the congregation looks together toward the Lord. And that's why the vestments that a priest wore at the traditional Mass always had a cross on the back of the vestment. He represented Christ going to do the sacrifice of the Mass, and the people would then follow Christ. Priest and people are in a procession together toward the Lord. They all set off for the Christ who comes to meet us. At the same time, we cannot reject all the reforms of our century wholesale. Some were not bad. Said it was important to distinguish the place for the liturgy of the Word from the place of the liturgy of the Eucharist. The liturgy of the Word is about speaking and proclaiming, so face-to-face does make a certain amount of sense there. A common turning to the east for the Eucharistic prayer remains essential. This is not accidental, but essential. Looking at the priest has no importance. What matters is looking together at the Lord. It is not a question of dialogue, but of common worship. What corresponds to the reality of what is happening is not the closed circle, but the common movement forward toward God. So then we go back to the spirit of the liturgy, page 82. And so Pope Benedict says, as I see it, the problem with a large part of modern liturgiology is that it tends to recognize only antiquity as a source and therefore normative, and to regard everything developed later in the Middle Ages and through the Council of Trent as decadent. And so one ends up with dubious reconstructions of the most ancient practice, fluctuating criteria, and never-ending suggestions for reform, which lead ultimately to the disintegration of the liturgy that has evolved into a living way. On the other hand, it's important and necessary to see that we cannot take as our norm the ancient in itself, and as such, nor must we automatically write off later developments as alien to the original form of liturgy. So you look and see what's good and what's not. One of the things Pope Pius XII was looking at before he died was doing something along the lines of what Vatican II called for, and that was taking some of the prayers and translating them into the vernacular and just doing them once. because the priest would do the epistle and the gospel in Latin, then come on the pulpit and say them again. Why say them twice? Just say them once, you know. So what is at issue is not a romantic escape into antiquity, but a rediscovery of something essential in which Christian liturgy expresses its permanent direction. It's not important precisely today to pray with the whole of creation, to find room for the dimension of the future, for hope in the Lord who is to come again, to recognize again, indeed, to live the dynamism. He said, is it not important to recognize indeed the dynamism of the new creation as an essential form of liturgy? So he's asking, are all these things important? Should we incorporate them in the liturgy? He says, if we're to see God in each other, and that's important that we do see God in each other, we must learn a new kind of seeing, and that is what the Eucharist is for. A more practical objection is, ought we be rearranging things all over again? Nothing is more harmful to the liturgy than a constant activism. So is there a solution? Yeah. One of the problems when they introduced the new Mass was that it was just kind of sprung on everybody without any preparation for the changes. And a lot of people got really mad and they left the church. A lot of priests left the priesthood because of it. One priest that I thought was my model of what a priest should be left. He was just so angry. So Ratzinger says, I see a solution provided by the insights of Erik Peterson. Facing east is linked with the cross and the second coming. Where a direct common turning to the east is not possible, the cross can serve as the interior east of faith. So he's saying it's really important to have that crucifix, you know, prominently displayed at the front of the church. You know, you ever hear Conte la Mesa, you know, the priest?
See.
Okay. He was the preacher of the papal household, right? He came to this area several years ago and gave a retreat. He was at Sacred Heart Church in Manassas. So I went to the retreat. The church was one of these modern churches, didn't have any kneelers. People were bringing in coffee and everything to drink during the thing. It was just terrible. So he comes in and starts talking, and then he makes a reference to the crucifix. He turns around and there's no crucifix. There's the risen Christ, you know, thing. He says, where's your crucifix? You know, he was very upset. He was ragging all over him about that. So that was kind of funny. So the cross should stand in the middle of the altar and be the common point of focus for both the priest and the praying community. And that's why Father Smith wanted to get that altar crucifix, which he didn't put back up there. In this way, we obey the ancient call to prayer, turn toward the Lord. In this way, we look together at the one whose death tore the veil of the temple, the one who stands before the Father for us and encloses us in his arms in order to make us the new and living temple. So St. Paul says, do you not know that you are a temple of the Holy Spirit? He says, moving the altar cross to the side to give an unimpeded view of the priest is something I regard as one of the truly absurd phenomenon of recent decades. This mistake should be corrected as quickly as possible. It can be done without further rebuilding. The Lord is the point of reference. He is the rising sun of history, not the priest. The tabernacle as a sacred tent. So the tabernacle takes the place of the tent of meeting that the Jews had crossing the desert during Exodus. The tabernacle is a sacred tent, as a place of the Shekinah, presence of God, the presence of the living Lord, developed in the second millennium. It was the fruit of passionate theological struggles and their resulting clarifications in which the permanent presence of Christ in the consecrated host emerged with great clarity. Because up until then, they didn't have the Eucharist in reserve in a tabernacle. They just would consume it or bring it to the homes of the other people, but it would all be consumed. There was no reservation of the Eucharist in it. That came out in this early time frame. So he says, here we run up against the decadence theory, the canonization of the early days, and the romanticism of the first century. transubstantiation, the adoration of our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament, Eucharistic devotions with monstrous processions are all alleged to be medieval errors from which we must once and for all take our leave. The Eucharistic gifts are for eating, not for looking at.
So transubstantiation, they're saying, is a medieval development?
That's what some people thought.
St. Thomas, and so they shouldn't. Because we did have a priest in Virginia who told the sisters not to use the word transubstantiation in teaching the kids.
Really?
And I was scandalized by that, because I thought
that was terrible.
The basis.
Yeah.
But I never knew that there was a reasoning against that.
Yeah, they were trying to, again, it was trying to get away from the idea that Jesus is the centerpiece of the liturgy and make it into a meal. It's all the effect. It's the post-Vatican II effect of all those changes, which led to a lot of liturgical abuses all over the place. Okay, we're going to stop here. It's past our time. We'll pick up here. We may finish next week. We'll come pretty close to it. So be thinking about which one to do next. Yeah, we've had a lot of ideas.
Could you summarize, from the beginning where we were at Mass to where we are now? At the end of this.
Yeah.
Because I'm honestly a little confused by what you say.
Okay, about what the Mass was and what it is now?
Yes.
Okay, sure. We could do that.
I'm one of those 98% that don't know too much about the Mass.
Well, we're going to change that.
That's why we're here.
We're going to bring her into the fold.
Well, my wife is much better, much more averse than me.
Okay.
I need you to.
No problem. We'll do that. Not a problem. Okay. So we'll pick up here next week. Anybody have any thoughts or questions or anything for what we covered today?
Hi, Jim. This is Mary Lou.
Hi.
I have been at a conference, and Father Straub was talking about it. He was telling a story about a woman who was bedridden, and she just wanted to get closer to God, and he said, just move your bed and face it in the direction of Tabernacle, wherever the closest church is. And I just thought that was a beautiful idea.
Yeah. That's right. It is a beautiful idea. But it's also consistent with everything Benedict is saying. Always orient yourself and your prayer toward God. And if you don't know what direction east is, which I usually don't, try to have something that brings it to your attention, like a crucifix or something, and then pray there toward the crucifix. So I made sure that I could do that because I put a crucifix over every door in my house. So whichever way I'm going, I look at the door and I can pray now. But yeah, that's important. Because you want to get yourself interiorly oriented toward God whenever you pray. So, okay, we'll see you next week. Thanks everybody for coming.
Thank you
for being here.
Have a good day.